Hello, everybody. I'm Guy Foster, and in this week's podcast, I'm going to be speaking to Paul Polman, former chief executive of Unilever for a decade, but also pioneer of sustainability over that time, and also an advocate of greater measures to tackle the huge issue of climate change and other market failures that have emerged. But bear in mind, this isn't investment advice. We can't guarantee sources from outside Brew and Dolphin, and tax legislation and allowances can change. Also, please remember that when investing your capital is at risk, investment values can increase or decrease because of currency fluctuations, and future performance can differ from that of the past. But now let's speak to Paul about those steps he thinks are necessary to solve some of these big market failures of our times. Okay, well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another Brew and podcast. As always, we're trying to bring you the brightest minds and the most influential thoughts to help you understand topical financial issues, and we're really pleased to be joined for this particular podcast by Paul Polman, who will be best known to many of us for serving as the CEO of Unilever for a decade. And during that time, Paul was known as a real pioneer of sustainability, despite obviously running a very profitable organization as well. Since leaving Unilever, Paul's co-founded Imagine, which is an organization of business leaders that recognizes the enormity of the challenges facing the world and sees business as having a choice about whether to be part of the problem or part of the solution. So, Paul, thanks very much for joining us and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
So we're seeing a steady stream of climate summits and commitments and even some plans in some cases. I wonder if you could just start by sort of giving your assessment of, you know, how much is being done and whether it's close to being enough or not.
Well, it's a good thing that 2020 was a turning point. Many people had expected that most of us and most companies would hunker down again to saving cost savings and protecting their companies. But instead, we've seen actually an acceleration of investments into more sustainable, more equitable models. And that is accelerating at a faster pace than we thought. So the good thing is that with the 2020, we have a, because we could not have the meetings at a global level, they all seem to be piling up in 2021. So the most important ones are the G7 and G20, now led by the UK and Italy, are very much focused on climate financing and developing markets and mitigation, as well as adaptation as it gets to climate change. Then we have the COP26 in Glasgow, a very important event because the countries, the individual countries, have to come in with their nationally determined commitments, which are really their decarbonization plans, not only for 2050, but also for 2030. And then we have the COP15 in Kunming, where biodiversity is high on the agenda. Nature and nature-based solutions have been a little bit the forgotten orphan until now, and or the forgotten stepchild is probably better. And they are so important in arriving to the climate change solutions that we need to put them higher on the agenda. To your question, where are we? Great progress. I think the Biden summit in the US probably closed the gap by 12 to 14%, but we're still far off track. 1.5 degrees is likely to be achieved in 2027 at the current rate, and we will be at 3 degrees before the end of the decade, the way we're going. So we do need to see these ambitions being stepped up. One of them is more countries making ambitions for 2050 in line with net zero targets, but increasingly also, what are they going to do in the next decade? And here the words and the actions don't fully match yet. At governmental level, but frankly also at company level. We see many companies making commitments of net zero, but banking on technologies that aren't there yet, be it hydrogen or carbon capture or battery technologies. And we cannot really afford the offsets. We really need to have absolute carbon reductions. So there is some work to do, but with a direction that is clear, with a momentum that is picking up, with increasing financing that is flowing in, regulations that come in place. So I think we're at a sweet spot that we now need to deliver on.
I think it's always really interesting to see these targets being announced by governments, because everyone's always really puzzled to know just how do they make that happen. So what's the connection between what the government says it needs to achieve, and then presumably the corporate and the household sectors that actually need to make the changes that are going to bring it about?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So, what is actually behind all these company commitments is a deep decarbonization plan on how they are going to achieve it. You can take any country as an example, because the plans that need to be put in place are obviously unique for each individual country. But take a country like Indonesia, a very big carbon emitter, the fifth biggest emitter in the world, and very important, for example, for Southeast Asia. They have their own institution, BAPENAS in this case, would be working with some of us in more detail to help bring a glide path that gives them economic growth and prosperity, lifting people out of poverty and a very much of a human agenda, but also a clear glide path to decarbonization. In a country like Indonesia, for example, nature-based solutions would be very important. There's three tropical forests left: the Amazons, the Congo Basin, and basically Papua, West Papua. And we would be working with them, for example, on nature-based solutions, on being sure that we get financing to flow in to protect these forests, to create sustainable livelihoods, to pay for natural capital increasingly. And putting these systems in place requires all of us, requires help from other countries that take some risks away and put money on the table, requires companies to make commitments to invest in Indonesia or convert supply chains like palm oil, for example, and it needs the governments themselves to work in harmony across their different divisions, put mechanisms in place on verification and enforcement. So this is really the broader partnerships that we're looking for, and that is true for each of the countries. You can look at the US, a big $2 trillion plan on infrastructure. That is a partnership between all the departments of the government, a partnership with the private sector. And even then, we need to ensure that it doesn't get derailed by others that have no interest to be on these aggressive conversion plans. Because one thing is for sure, although we know what is needed, it's not going to be easy. The size and scale of these changes are enormous. We should not belittle that or underestimate that.
Well, I guess you kind of alluded to it there a bit. I mean, is there the political will? Is there the consensus? Does the consensus exist to make the strides and make the efforts that need to be made in order to address this massive challenge?
Well, Paris sent a clear signal in with the COP21 that we were going to tackle climate change. What the private sector needs above all is consistency and a sense of direction where we are going. We have seen things change quite drastically since Paris, especially around stranded assets and the fossil fuel sector, a little bit less on the nature-based solutions, which, as I said, are such an important part of the equation. Now momentum is clearly building, because COVID, I think, has been a bigger warning sign than people had realized. The fact that you can't have healthy people on an unhealthy planet, the fact that our destruction of biodiversity is not only causing the climate change but drives further inequality or pandemics and all that, I think it has moved it closer to the agenda. The countries have to spend significant amounts of money to get their economies going again, and that is obviously a unique opportunity to have the debate, but also the action plans to ensure that that money is spent right. So there is certain momentum around this coming in from the financial market, which clearly has moved beyond risk mitigation to opportunities. And we see rapidly moving funds. Mike Carney announced the $70 trillion on the Glasgow Financial Alliance for net zero. We see most of the investors asking for disclosure, obviously a high need to put the measurements and transparency in place. the TCFD, the Task Force for Financial Disclosure on Climate-Related Risk, is being taken up in more and more countries in their jurisdiction, if you want to. So there are things or steps that are being taken that take some of these bottlenecks away. But the amount of financing that needs to flow into the direction of decarbonizing our global economy is significantly higher than what is currently happening. And then obviously the issue of the emerging markets. Whilst we have caused the climate change, we cannot be solemnly solving it. We need to be sure that where all the investments and the growth are, which is in the Far East and in the Deep South, if you want to, that all the cities that we're building, all the investments that we're making to provide energy or to expand our food systems to feed the growing population, we need to be sure that they're all done in a climate smart way.
And I mean, thinking of things from an economist's perspective, I find it really helpful this example that climate change is the biggest instance of market failure in history. And what I'd always hoped was that once the issue is well known, then consumer tastes will change, and consumer and businesses will respond to those changing consumer tastes. And we as investors, we can just invest in the companies that are responding to the changes in tastes. I guess, you know, looking more deeply at it, you do kind of realize, or it seems to me like there are some consumer tastes that are just not really changing fast enough. There are some whole industries, think things like fast fashion, where there's always going to be a meaningful cohort that is really interested in those areas. And that means that market is going to continue to fail. So how do we address those kind of challenges where consumer tastes just aren't changing fast enough?
Well, we have relied on the markets broadly, and it has lifted so many people out of poverty. Obviously, over the last five decades, we've lifted more people out of poverty than in any time in human history. But unfortunately, as you mentioned, that we've done that in an unsustainable and, I would argue, inequitable way. We have benefited from globalization, but we have not taken care of the downsides of globalization for many parts of the population. We have enjoyed the economic growth, but we have not taken care of the planet itself that we need. Most of the businesses, directly or indirectly, are linked to nature and depend on nature. So these are the tragedies of the commons. I would say more than the tragedies of the commons, they are the tragedies of humanity, where personal interest has taken precedent over the interest of the common good. So we can address it to some extent by the private sector alone and by the markets, which are clearly seeing the pain points coming in, seeing the restrictions on growth that it is offering, getting the pressures from people and partners in their value chains. So there is a self-correction, but that self-correction is clearly not enough. We do need the right policies in place, and we do need different business models as well as innovations. And that obviously is an enormous opportunity. We're going to solve it. The question is only how long does it take us to solve it? Every day that we wait, there is a human tragedy somewhere in the world, and these human tragedies seem to be multiplied. So there is a moral obligation to move fast. But increasingly, we're at the point also that it is an economic justification to move fast. Anybody that would be focused on fiduciary duties around the shareholders will now automatically be led, for most of the industries, towards ESG to do this. If you neglect now the ESG thinking and actions into your business models, you put actually shareholder value creation at risk. So the question here then becomes very clearly, how fast can we move, and how can we rally everybody around that? Because it's not really one party alone that can do this. And that requires sometimes a upfront investment for a longer term benefit. But as we're talking about the future of humanity, it strikes me that that is worth taking, especially after just coming out of a moment where the global economy has suffered to the tune of $22 trillion from the COVID crisis alone. So there must be better ways to design our future development paths.
Okay, well, Paul, I know your time's very precious, but tell me, just before you go, would you be able to give us a flavour of what you've been doing with Imagine to help address the major issues that the world is facing?
Well, Imagine is very simply focused on the Sustainable Development Goals, especially the acceleration around climate change and inequality to solve that. And we think that our theory of change is very simple. Companies can only do so much, as we've talked, and much more needs to be done collectively. But there are things that get in the way. There are competitive pressures, there are these market failures, there's probably knowledge gaps, there's capability gaps. So what we create is a neutral platform where we bring a critical mass of CEOs by industry sector across the value chain together. So it's by industry sector, CEOs, critical mass across the value chain. And we can address some issues by making more of the challenges that need to be addressed pre-competitive. Plastics in the oceans, moving to regenerative agriculture, changing consumer nutritional habits to healthy diets. These are things that concern the whole industry that not each individual company alone is able to solve. By getting a critical mass of 20 to 30% of the CEOs, we can address issues of the value chain. We build trust. So where one invests and the other gets the benefits, we can solve that. We can bring in some more aggressive targets. Collectively, the CEOs become more courageous. And we have a critical mass to deal with civil society and governments to ensure that we also get them on board and get the right frameworks around us. So it's a theory of change that we focus on the main industries that have the biggest impact on the Sustainable Development Goals. Obviously, the energy transition, which gets a lot of attention, but we should not underestimate the fashion industry, the food and land use, the financial sector, and now we're starting to work also on tourists and travel. All very important for the economy, be it in job creation or be it depending on nature-based services, and all of them need to pivot their business model. The ultimate question will be, how do they grow when you have finite resources? So you cannot have unlimited growth when you have finite resources. Anything that is, by definition, not long-term feasible is unsustainable. So can we bend these business models towards different growth patterns where you use less material, where you make it more inclusive, is ultimately what we are focused on. And by all means possible, by the way.
Okay, Paul, well, thank you so much for explaining all of that. It's been really, really useful to hear it from someone who has worked in this area for such a long time and with such great success as well. So thanks to you, and thanks also to all of our listeners. Hopefully you've found this a really thought-provoking discussion of the major issues, and hopefully you'll be joining us again for a future edition of the Bruin podcast.